Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Ladaris Hazard Cordell, a retired California State Court judge, former Stanford University Vice Provost, and currently the Independent Police Auditor for the City of San Jose, California, and your moderator for today's program. Our guest is Ian Haney Lopez, one of the nation's leading thinkers on how racism has evolved in the United States since the Civil Rights era. He is a constitutional law scholar and the John H. Bolt Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. His current research emphasizes the connection between racial divisions in society and growing wealth inequality in the United States. His most recent book, Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class, lays bare how conservative politicians exploit racial pandering to convince many voters to support policies that ultimately favor the very rich and hurt everyone else. Ian Haney Lopez holds a master's in history from Washington University, a master's in public policy from Princeton, and a law degree from Harvard. In 2011, Haney Lopez received an Alphonse Fletcher Fellowship awarded to scholars whose work furthers the integration goals of Brown versus Board of Education. I am thrilled that he is here, and once you hear from him, and I guarantee once you have read his book, you will be thrilled, even more thrilled, that he is here to talk about his latest book. Welcome, please, Professor Ian Haney Lopez. Go for it.
Thank you, Judge Cordell, for that welcome, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for having me here. So the title of my book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Let me start with the concept of dog whistle politics. Think about things like food stamp president, welfare queen, illegal alien. These are dog whistles. So a literal dog whistle is a whistle that uses a high frequency such that it's not audible to humans, but is audible to dogs. And the metaphor here is political speech, which on one level doesn't say anything about race. So food stamp president, ostensibly it's just about food stamps, or welfare queen, maybe it's just welfare, or illegal alien, it's just about law breaking and crossing the border. But on another level, this is a sort of speech that triggers strong racial reactions. And the idea here is that this sort of dog whistling, this sort of use of coded racial appeals, is pervasive in American politics today. Now, this argument so far shouldn't be all that controversial. At least two chairs of the Republican National Committee, one in 2005 and one in 2010, admitted to the use of racial appeals under the name of the Southern Strategy, but admitted that the Republicans have been using racial appeals for decades. True, most people understand this as marginal, that it's exceptional. Most people understand it as vestigial, that somehow this is a holdover from the sort of pre-civil rights days. So the book lays bare 50 years of dog whistling from basically 1964 to the present. And in that sense, the book provides a dramatic illustration of how this is actually central and continuous. But I want to say that that's really only half the project of the book and not the important half. The important half is to say racial dog whistling isn't just about winning votes. Racial dog whistling has a particular vision of government associated with it. There's a particular political project, and that project is to attack New Deal liberalism. The project of dog whistling is to demonize government itself in a way that it allows conservatives to argue that voters are best served by turning against government. And this helps connect 50 years of dog whistle politics, and also 50 years of assaults on the middle class. Or put differently, this is a book that really seeks to explain not race and politics first and foremost, but instead where we find ourselves today. So we find ourselves in the wake of the Great Recession, the biggest economic calamity since the Great Depression, in which people lost jobs, people lost value in their homes, they lost their homes, they lost their retirement, they see no upward route of mobility for themselves, no return to work, many of them for themselves, no route of upward mobility for their children. And to the extent that there's been a recovery, it's been euphemistically referred to as a jobless recovery, which is another way of saying 95% of the recovery has gone to the top 1% of the country, and we today have levels of wealth inequality we haven't seen in a century. And the question is, how do we get here? This is a book that's going to say a principal way in which we got here is racial politics. But I really want people to understand this is a book that isn't about race centrally, it's about what's happened to our economy and what's happened to our democracy. Okay, so how does racial dog whistle politics connect up with the fate of the middle class? Let me give you one short story. So Ronald Reagan is infamous for engaging in sort of racial politics. He opened his official campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where just 16 years earlier, three civil rights workers had been lynched. And when he opened his campaign there, he did so to extol states' rights. At a point when people understood that states' rights meant the right of southern states to resist integration. So there's this history of race baiting in the politics, in the campaigning of Ronald Reagan. But I want to share a different story. I want to tell a story that Reagan used to tell. He used to talk to audiences about their frustration. He would sympathize with their frustration. He'd say, I understand how angry you are when you're standing in line waiting to buy hamburger, and some young fellow ahead of you is buying a T-bone steak with food stamps. Now, the first time he told this story, in case you don't understand the racial element, the first time he told this story, he said, some young buck. Right? And a buck, a southern term understood to mean a strong black man. Right? Clearly what Reagan was conjuring was the image of blacks who are able to work, but simply prefer not to. And in fact, are happier ripping off the system rather than working, right? So this is the image of not just the lazy African-American, but the African-American who's gaming the system, who's ripping people off, who prefer welfare to work. That's one image in this story. And I should say, he dropped the phrase, some young buck, but he persisted with that story. There's another character in this story, and that's the you in the audience that Reagan's talking to. That you is implicitly white. It's the white middle class, working hard, struggling to make ends meet, playing by the rules, paying taxes. And so here we see that he's telling this story about some young fellow ahead of you in line buying T-bone steak with food stamps. This is a dog whistle. On one level, he doesn't have to mention race, because on another, the racial narrative of blacks ripping off liberal government and of whites being suckers is so powerful, so latent in that story. So that's the way that story is working in terms of racial politics. But how's it working in terms of economic politics? Well, there's a third character in the story. The third character is government itself. Ostensibly, it's government that is slipping its hands deep into the pocket of the hardworking white middle-class taxpayer, taking their hard-earned dollars and giving it to these scheming minorities. It's government, Reagan is saying, that's the real enemy. And so he urged voters into a tax rebellion. He said, stop paying taxes. Don't pay taxes. You need a tax cut, because if you get a tax cut, that's what's going to keep your money from being transferred to these lazy-about, scheming, no-good minorities. And so under Reagan, the country enacted tax cuts. And over the 1980s, $1 trillion in wealth was transferred through these tax cuts to the middle class? No. To the top 1%. And every decade since then, these Reagan tax cuts have transferred another $1 trillion in wealth to the top 1%. Now, I'm going to fast forward to 2014 or 2012. What about Mitt Romney? Right? Because we can see dog whistle politics clearly in the past. We can see it in the Philadelphia speech about states' rights. We can see it in Reagan's references to food stamps, in his reference to welfare queens. What about Mitt Romney? Mitt Romney, in the summer of 2012, spent half his advertising dollars, on an ad that tried to tie Barack Obama to welfare. He had a campaign slogan that said, under Clinton, welfare to work, you had to go to work, but under Obama, welfare to work is going to be plain old welfare. Now, several points. One, the factual predicate for this ad was false. There was no basis for this ad. And indeed, PolitiFact gives Romney a pants-on-fire rating for this ad, and it's in response to that that a Romney campaign official turns around and says, we won't let our campaign be dictated by the facts. No, because what's important are not the facts, it's the frame. And the frame is, this black president is really all about welfare. In the same way that Reagan was using welfare, the image of lazy blacks who prefer welfare and who are ripping off the system, but also in the sense that Obama now embodies the government. So this is no longer liberal government for minorities. This is now ostensibly liberal government by and for minorities. That's the message that Romney is spreading. But there's another way in which Romney engages in dog whistle politics, and it's another quote that might be more familiar to you, but which usually isn't understood as dog whistle politics. Remember that Romney was secretly taped giving a campaign speech in which he disparaged 47% of the country. Right? Now, he said of these people, the point that he was making was there's 47% of the people who don't pay federal income tax, which is true. What he was neglecting to mention is that they often pay Social Security tax, and that when you combine Social Security tax plus also sales tax, most Americans are actually paying higher than the 14% that Romney himself was paying. But again, he didn't mention that. What he said instead is these people are people who refuse to take responsibility for themselves, who have an entitlement mentality, that they think they're entitled to health care and to work and to housing, right? But that they're simply irresponsible. Now, notice what he's doing. He's taking the language that has previously been used to describe minorities and he's transferring it to half the country, but implicitly to many whites. And so there's this element of dog whistle politics of having darkened any person who seeks government assistance or who might need government assistance. All right, that's true. On another level, though, think about what Mitt Romney was advocating, what he was telling us he would do. In addition to tying Obama to welfare, in addition to darkening half the country for needing government assistance, Mitt Romney turned around and here's what he promised. He said, in the wake of this Great Recession, where the wealthy are wealthier now than they have been in 100 years, he promised to cut taxes for the very rich. He also said, in the wake of the Great Recession caused by financial deregulation in the financial market, that he would get rid of government regulation of industry. He also said, in the context of this Great Recession and so many people in need, that he would slash social services. Indeed, Paul Ryan, his running mate, promised to close large segments of government altogether. Romney campaigned on an anti-New Deal politics that essentially promised to do everything that would hurt the middle class and further transfer resources to the very rich. And here's what's really important. Though Romney lost, he did not lose among whites. Mitt Romney won 3 out of every 5 white votes. And now we tend to diminish the significance of that by saying, okay, that was about white men. No. Mitt Romney also won a majority among white women. Or we tend to downplay it by saying, well, this is something that's regional. Maybe this is just the southern whites. No. Mitt Romney won a majority of the white vote in 46 out of 50 states. Or, looking to the future and being optimistic, we say, yeah, but the youth is post-racial. This is just older whites. No. In every single age cohort, including the youngest white voters, Mitt Romney won a majority. Here is where we are today. We live in a political system in which one political party has essentially defined itself by race. The Republican Party draws 90% of its support from whites. 98% of elected Republican state officials are white. But it's not just race as in identity. In fact, it's not race as identity at all. That's not what matters. It's race as a worldview. And the worldview says the biggest threat in our lives, ostensibly, are poor minorities rather than the very rich. This is the country we now live in. And we might take heart in the fact that Barack Obama won, and that's great. Okay, so this sort of politics didn't transfer at the presidential level. But it dominates the House. It dominates in states like Wisconsin and North Carolina. Right? This politics is real. And now I'm just going to salt the field with questions. I'm going to sit down right now. But it's not going away. Demographically, we cannot rely on demography alone to overcome this sort of dog whistle politics. All right. Now I'll sit down and we'll begin with questions.
Great. Thank you. You know, while preparing for this interview, I was asked by a friend who's here in the audience, Tobias. I was asked by a friend, and he said, so, have you found, a couple of zingers in the book that you can kind of bring up? And I chuckled because this book is full of them. I started off, and you'll see I have a lot of Post-its on this book, because I said, oh, wow. And then I put another Post-it. Finally, it got to the point where I ran out of Post-its, and I ended up just highlighting the rest. This is an amazing book, Professor Haney Lopez, and I commend you for this, because this book actually says what a lot of us maybe kind of knew but didn't know how to say it. And you've now said it. And I just think you've done a tremendous service to those of us who really want to understand really what's going on, particularly in the political landscape. So, let me just start off by reading you an excerpt from, just a very short excerpt, from a New York Times article. Candidate for Texas governor stands by outspoken musician. It's about Ted Nugent, and the attorney general is running in Texas for Governor Greg Abbott. And Ted Nugent called President Obama a communist-nurtured subhuman mongrel. And in response, Mr. Abbott defended continuing to have Mr. Nugent with him on the campaign trail. And he said, this is Mr. Abbott saying things like, Nugent is a fighter for freedom. He also said that Mr. Nugent, while he may sometimes say things or use language that he would not endorse or agree with, we appreciate the support of everyone who supports protecting our Constitution. Do you hear the dog whistle?
So that's the sort of dog whistle that you would think would be so egregious that no one could get away with it. A subhuman mongrel? And I think look, dog whistles work because they allow plausible deniability. The whole idea, the claim is not that race has not previously played a role in American politics. Race has long played a role in American campaigns. The claim is, after the civil rights movement, open expressions of naked bigotry simply became unacceptable as a country as a whole endorsed an ethos of racial egalitarianism. And what that required was that politicians who wanted to trade on racial appeals, who wanted to provoke racial fears, needed to use coded language that on one level triggered racial anxiety, but on another allowed them to deny that they were doing any such thing. So the whole idea is plausible deniability, is subtlety. But by the time you're welcoming the endorsement of a social figure, a public figure who says subhuman mongrel, we're actually veering back towards open racism. And this is really remarkable. Democrats have been telling themselves for 50 years, look, this is just about latent bigotry in the population. This is going to go away. But 50 years later, not only has it not gone away, but in some ways, it's not clear to me that you could use language like subhuman mongrel in the 60s. In some ways, we're actually going backwards in terms of the public acceptability of racial speech. It seems to be, what is the standard? As long as Nugent doesn't use a racial epithet? As long as he doesn't use the N-word, then he hasn't crossed the line. This is a really, really remarkable episode, and that a politician campaigning for governor could accept that endorsement and defend it that tells us a lot about how powerful race is going to be in the 2014 elections, particularly regionally in a state like Texas.
And it's particularly using words like protect the Constitution. I think at one point he actually calls him a blood brother. And again, sending out the message, right? So let's talk about another issue that is really on the horizon now. And actually, it's more on the less on the horizon. It's right here. And that's the Stand Your Ground laws. So there is this proliferation of states enacting Stand Your Ground laws. Is that a response to dog whistle politics?
I think Stand Your Ground laws are a form of dog whistle politics. Here's what I'd say. I want to make a very strong claim that race is the principal way in which social issues have been used to demonize government. But I want to be clear, it's not the exclusive way. Conservatives have been using a sort of a culture war politics for 50 years. What are the elements of that of those culture wars? Gender, equal pay, women in the workplace, abortion, marriage equality, right, guns, religion. All of these are ways in which conservatives have said to voters, the biggest threat in your life is liberal government in hock to a society that has lost its way. Don't fear concentrated wealth. Don't fear corporations. Don't pay attention to surging wealth inequality. Fear a society that has lost its way morally, right? That's the overarching narrative. Now, again, I want to insist race is the early model. Race is the principal mechanism. Indeed, when we locate people along a conservative liberal spectrum and we ask, what do we know about people if we know they're liberal or conservative? The thing we're most likely to know is their racial attitudes. Right? So race is really the core. But again, it's not the exclusive sort of cultural provocation. Guns are a related sort of cultural provocation. There's this idea of Second Amendment, protect your rights. Here's what I want to say about that. All of these are working together. Guns and race are working together. The idea that guns are threatened is also, that gun rights are under threat is also connected to the idea that minorities are taking over a society and that whites need to protect themselves. And so these Stand Your Ground laws, on one level, it's just about gun rights and your ability. Well, here, I just want to pause here just to make sure people understand what Stand Your Ground law is, because this is just is an extraordinary idea. Under the law of self-defense, typically, you have a duty to retreat if you can. And the idea is, you know, someone comes to rob you, someone wields a weapon. That's not a capital offense. Don't kill them. Retreat if you can. Right, that is respectful of human life. You don't know what's going on with them. All right, this isn't an ego contest. If you can safely retreat, retreat, and you don't get a self-defense claim if you didn't retreat. Stand Your Ground laws say you don't need to retreat. Stand Your Ground laws even say if you initiated the provocation, but they react in a way that you feel is threatening, you can use lethal force. This is, you know, I would say law of the jungle, but I actually think this is the law of adolescent fantasy, right? This is ego tripping, where people are like, nobody's going to bully me. I'll just take out my gun and blow them away. We're more mature than that as a society, or we used to be, but we've gone backwards. And I think that part of the racial imagery, part of the imagery that's fueling Stand Your Ground laws is racial. It's exactly the situation that played out with Jordan Davis in Florida. Young black teenager playing music too loud, white driver, middle-aged driver, ask him to turn it down. He responds by saying no and, you know, maybe uses an expletive or two. Now, the driver's in his car. He can pull away. But instead he reaches into his glove box, pulls out a gun, and shoots this young black teenager 3 times. And the jury will convict him of second-degree murder because after the car pulled away, after the car with the black teenagers pulled away, he got out of the car, kneeled, and fired 7 more shots. They'll convict him for that. But they don't convict him for killing Jordan Davis. And the imagery here is No person should have to put up with that sort of disrespect, but it's racial disrespect. It's racial threat that's operating here. So stand your ground laws, I think, are operating a very powerful dog whistle. They're saying to many whites, you're under threat. You need guns. You need to protect yourself. Government won't protect you. In fact, government's part of the threat. They're trying to take your guns, but you're under threat. And who is that threat? An increasing number of minorities, and in particular, young black and brown kids.
So as a quick follow-up on that, at the trials of Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis, race was never mentioned. Race was not brought up. And that picks up on another issue in your book about the silence, specifically of Democrats, when conservatives and Republicans are pushing on this. So what is your take on the silence? Why was it race not mentioned when it was central in these cases?
We, as a country, have lost tremendous ground in how we understand racism. In the 1960s, in the civil rights movement, we used to understand that racism took a variety of forms. That some racism was naked bigotry, but some racism was unconscious, and some racism was institutionalized. Patterns, practices, settings, distributions of resources that would have the effect of perpetuating racial inequality without any intervention. It was a complex, sophisticated understanding of racism. Since then, we've lost ground, and we've lost ground because conservatives have had a specific project of redefining, of narrowing the definition of racism. Today, racism means only express bigotry or express references to race. And this is crucial, and this is lies at the heart of the success of dog whistle politics. If only express bigotry or express references to race constitutes racism, then when somebody says welfare cheat or when somebody says thug music, it's not racism because they didn't use a racial epithet and they didn't reference race. But if in turn somebody says, hey, that sounds a lot like racial animosity, that sounds a lot like racial stereotyping, they just mentioned race. And by this calculus, they are the racists. So in this conversation, Democrats in particular, but really sort of almost all of society has been shut down so that we have a racial discourse which is suffused by racial innuendos from the right, couched in cultural terms. And we meet it from the center and from the left with silence. And we're silent because we worry that if we speak up, if we say, hey, this is triggering racial fears, hey, this is playing on racial biases, we'll be accused of being the racist. Right? You see this in microcosm in these trials. The prosecutor in the Trayvon Martin case doesn't want to talk about race, even though this is about somebody who's describing this young African-American man as a hoodie, as someone who's up to no good, who's clearly a troublemaker. The prosecutor in the Jordan Davis case doesn't mention race, even though this is about a middle-aged white guy pulling out a gun and firing into a carload of four black teenagers, who he described as playing thug music. Of course it's about race, but the prosecutors don't feel that they can safely mention it, because if they do, someone's going to turn around and say, you're playing the race card. You're the real source of racial division in our society. This is what the Democrats have been doing too. Democrats have been losing ground through dog whistle politics for 50 years, and at every turn they say to themselves, let's just not talk about race. Because if we talk about race, we'll be accused of playing the race card, we'll be accused of being divisive, maybe this will just blow over. And as I said, especially when you look at that Ted Nugent quote, this isn't going away. As a strategy, we lose when we fail to accost continuing racism in our society.
Just as a reminder, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to Professor Ian Haney-Lopez, Berkeley Law Professor and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. I'm Ladaris Hazard Cordell, your moderator, and you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online on our YouTube channel. Professor Haney-Lopez, as I was reading your book, I was shocked many times, and I was particularly shocked by the dog whistle politics you attribute to a variety of presidential candidates. And I'm just going to pull out two. And this is directly from your book, referring to Bill Clinton. Clinton understood the political advantage in race baiting and chose to use it. Clinton bit down on that whistle and blew. Bill Clinton was as deft a dog whistle racist as Wallace, Nixon, or Reagan before him. And then you write about President Obama. Obama largely exonerated dog whistle politics while faulting excessive liberal zeal for causing a racial backlash. Talk to us about these two.
So I just said that Democrats typically respond to dog whistling with silence. It turns out that's the best case. That occasionally Democrats adopt a, if we can't beat them, we should join them attitude. And that's Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton understood that the Democrats were losing power, were losing votes, but the New Deal coalition of Northeastern liberals, of Southern Democrats and of African Americans was being broken apart through racial appeals. And Clinton decided he'd adopt those appeals himself. He did it in his campaign when he purposefully provoked a confrontation with Jesse Jackson. He did it in his substantive policies when he ended welfare and when he dramatically expanded Reagan's war on drugs into a generic war on crime. And I want to make a point here. When the Democratic Party adopts dog whistle politics, like the Republicans, this is not just about racial rhetoric. It's about policy. The Democratic Party as a whole has shifted to the right. Following the Republicans, still to the left of the Republicans, true, but the Democratic Party, in adopting dog whistle themes, has shifted to the right. Now, in the quote that the judge just read, I describe Clinton as deft a dog whistle racist as reviled figures like George Wallace. What do I mean? Here's what I'm driving at. Dog whistle racism is a form of strategic racism. It's not about bigotry. It's not about prejudice. It's not, I mean, we know about Richard Nixon, for example, because of his secret tapes, taped him being a bigot. So we know, yeah, he was a bigot. He was a racist. But when Nixon adopts dog whistle strategies in 1970 and then aggressively in 1972, it's a strategy. He is thinking long and hard about how to get elected. And as he looks around to what weapons are available to him, he sees racial anxiety laying on the ground and he picks it up and he uses it. It's a strategy. Same thing with Bill Clinton. I don't think Bill Clinton is personally a bigot. I think Bill Clinton holds many African Americans in high esteem, in particular his buddy Vernon Jordan. Okay, that's not the point. The point is that as Clinton looked around to see what strategy he could use to get elected, he saw racial anxiety, and he leaned over and he picked up that weapon and he used it, not just in his campaigns, but also in the policies that he pursued. What about Barack Obama? I think in some ways Obama is a more complicated case. I think in some domains Obama himself has used dog whistle politics. I am especially critical of Obama in the area of immigration. Obama understands full well that hysteria over undocumented immigrants presented as illegal aliens has been a core element of Republican strategy over the last decade. I mean, it extends further back, but especially over the last decade. He understands that full well. How did he respond? He responded by taking an extremely hard line on deportations. Barack Obama has deported almost 1.9 million people, more than any other American president, in order to show that he's tough on immigrants. And what has this bought him? When John Boehner reversed course on immigration reform just a couple of weeks ago, Boehner said, we Republicans can't pursue immigration reform because we can't trust President Obama to enforce the laws. This isn't about facts, it's about frames. And the frame is Democrats are beholden to minorities, including brown lawbreakers, undocumented immigrants who are streaming across the border. Democrats want to make them citizens so they'll vote Democratic. That's the frame, and that's all they need is a frame. Obama made a terrible political blunder, but much worse than that, a terrible, humane, grievous error in not confronting that frame, but instead seeking to conform his policy to it by showing that he, too, could be tough on immigrants and deport people, 400,000 people a year. And these are families, brothers, sisters, children, parents. This is inhumane. And yet Obama does it, and I think he has done it with a clear eye of how this fits into a racial politics that he's hoping to avoid. Okay, so that's one level. I don't think Obama is a Bill Clinton in aggressively pursuing white voters through dog whistle politics. Instead, he's doing something else. And I'm going to call this post-racialism. Now, we can understand the concept of post-racialism as a claim about society, a claim that we're beyond race. If you listen to my remarks, clearly that's absurd. And I don't think Obama thinks we're beyond race. Instead, post-racialism for Obama is a strategy. And here's what he's saying. Race is so volatile, it's so incendiary, that even though racism continues, even though race is a part of our political dynamics today, we should pretend as if race is irrelevant. And we can get more done if we pretend that race is irrelevant. Now, this isn't just Obama, by the way. This is the Democratic Party. I think it's also a lot of unions. I think it's a lot of foundations. A lot of the center, liberal, progressive, a coalition has adopted a notion of post-racialism that says, we're going to do better if we never talk about race. Here's the fundamental error. Race doesn't just attach to minorities anymore. 50 years after 50 years of this dog whistle politics, race attaches to liberalism itself. Any solution you propose that involves New Deal activist liberal government is already tainted with a racial cast. And I think Obama intuits this and understands that not only must he keep his distance from minorities, he must keep his distance from liberalism. He can't afford to come out for a single-payer system, for example. And that's at his most liberal. He can't afford to come out strongly in defense of unions. He can't afford to come out strongly for progressive taxation and for a rollback of the Bush tax cuts. He keeps folding on all of those issues. Why? Maybe it's his temperament. Maybe it's that he's at his heart conservative. But I actually think he understands that it's liberalism itself that has a racial cast. And he worries that, not just as a Democrat, but as an African-American, that he can't afford to talk about race or even to really embrace liberalism. And what is the result? Post-racialism tells us we're not going to talk about race and that's how we're going to get things done. But post-racialism actually manifests itself as a flight from race and from liberalism. So getting things done means shifting the Democratic Party further and further in a centrist or right-wing direction. Right? And so I'll just stop with this quote. President Obama, right after his re-election, said, if I had the same policies today that I do, if you put me in the 1980s with the same policies I espouse today, I would be a moderate Republican. And he's right. That's exactly right. The Democratic Party today, the policies that Obama espouses are actually more similar to the policies of Ronald Reagan than even, and here's this, they're more similar to the policies of Ronald Reagan than even to the policies of Richard Nixon in 1968. The Republicans have shifted dramatically to the right, and the Democrats have followed because they've adopted a strategy of not confronting dog whistle politics, of occasionally themselves, of embracing it. This strategy of seeking not to talk about race is a failure, because not only must the Democrats flee race, they feel they must flee liberalism itself.
More than half of the questions that I've received from the audience ask about where we're headed and what we can do, and I promise you we will get to that. But I want to get to another issue. There is a line by Justice Harlan in a dissent that has just been quoted repeatedly especially by conservatives and oftentimes by Democrats, and this notion of color blindness. We're in a color blind, we want to be in a color blind society. You talk quite a bit about color blindness in the book. Talk to us about it.
So color blindness is a very powerful liberal idea that has been hijacked and is now our worst enemy. As a liberal idea, colorblindness says we should treat people as if race doesn't matter. Look to the content of people's character, not to the color of their skin. And what Martin Luther King meant when he said that was, don't let stereotypes cloud your judgment. Don't judge people by their race. Judge them by who they really are. Interact with people. Treat people as if racism doesn't really matter. That's a beautiful ideal, and I hope and aspire to get there as a society. Conservatives have hijacked colorblindness, and here's the way they've hijacked it. They say we should act about race and assume that, in fact, race does not matter. We should pretend that race is irrelevant, that race has no bearing. Now, that's insane. Race matters tremendously in our society. We see it in our criminal justice system. We see it in healthcare outcomes. We see it in jobs. We see it in housing. We see it in American politics. Yes, on an individual level, we should treat each other in a way that recognizes our shared humanity. But we should not engage in society as if race is irrelevant. In fact, if we engage in society as if race is irrelevant, that ends up being really destructive. How is it destructive? Because colorblindness then fuels into this redefinition of racism as any mention of race. This is how the Supreme Court currently understands racism. Supreme Court currently says racism is when you mention race. Who mentions race? Affirmative action programs. And the Supreme Court responds to that by saying, well, since race doesn't matter, there can't be any reason for affirmative action other than racism itself. Strike down all affirmative action programs. On the other hand, the Supreme Court also says, since racism only exists when race is mentioned, we can't see discrimination against minorities. So the Supreme Court has a malice test for measuring discrimination against minorities that it adopted in 1979, when Jimmy Carter was in the White House. And using that test, since 1979, the Supreme Court, with a core of five conservative justices, has never found discrimination against minorities since. Not since 1979 has the Supreme Court, using a malice test, found discrimination against minorities. But every time it confronts affirmative action, it invokes colorblindness and says, hey, you guys, University of California, you just mentioned race. University of Michigan, you just mentioned race. And it tends to strike these down, with a small exception of higher education. Yeah, affirmative action in higher education is hanging on, it's on life support. But affirmative action in contracting, affirmative action in the workplace, it's dead, and it's dead because of colorblindness. This same term is killing us politically, because it's colorblindness that says, as long as conservatives dog whistle but don't mention race, not racism. But the minute progressives or liberals respond by saying, hey, this is racial demagoguery, that's the racism, right? That's colorblindness. And again, I want to be really clear. I love colorblindness as an aspiration, where we say we want to recognize each other, we want to recognize each other's humanity. But colorblindness is an absurdity if it's understood to mean race has no social meaning in our society, and that's why it's always wrong to mention race. Right? That's absurd, and it's incredibly destructive.
Another zinger. Race convinces many whites to vote against their interests. What's the matter with white voters?
And that, I think, is the big money question. I'm not going to answer that because I'm hoping you'll buy the book. Okay, so I will answer that. Listen, I talked about dog whistle politicians. We need an understanding of racisms, not just a single racism. And so with respect to dog whistle politicians, I said they're strategic racists. And what I mean by that is this isn't about bigotry. This is about their recognizing that they can manipulate racial animosity to their own advantage. What's that advantage? Well, for a lot of them, it's getting votes. But more fundamentally and more destructively for the middle class, it's in order to wage war against New Deal liberalism. It's not really about race, right? And that's why, this is a sense, it's strategic. I don't think that strategic racism describes most voters. Let's take the Tea Party, for example. I think Tea Partiers are people who are responding very strongly to dog whistle themes. What are they most concerned about? They're most concerned about Muslims and the idea that Obama might be a Muslim. They're concerned about Sharia in the heartland. They're concerned about undocumented immigrants. They're concerned about welfare. They're concerned about 50 years of dog whistle themes. Are they bigots? Some on the left have said, yeah, they're bigots. No, I think that's wrong. I think that they're people in crisis. I think that just like a lot of Americans, they've lost their jobs, they've lost their homes, their pay has been slashed, their benefits are eroding, they're in crisis, and they're looking around for an understanding of what's happening to them. And the most powerful frame they're being offered, or at least the most powerful frame that resonates with them, is a narrative that America has lost its way because of the surging population of minorities and is threatening minorities who are taking over and degrading our society. But again, I don't understand this as conscious bigotry. Rather, I understand this as something that I call in the book common sense racism, or that I might call routine racism. Racism that comes out of a subscription to powerful social stereotypes about whites and about minorities that also reflects established patterns in our society. When you look at the suburbs and the cities, when you look at elite educational institutions and community colleges, when you look at the halls of Congress versus the population of the post office, you see race. Race is built deeply into our society, and it continually reaffirms that race is relevant. I think many white voters are drawing upon a common sense of racism at an unconscious level when they react to these dog whistle themes. And it's important that it's unconscious. Yes, I think there are some white voters who, if they heard a politician say to them, I want you to vote for me because minorities are out to get you and I want to invoke white solidarity, I think there are some few white voters who say, yeah, that guy's got my vote. But by and large, most whites, most Tea Party members would repudiate that. That's not who they are. And I think they're completely genuine when they say it's outrageous to call us racist. We are not racist. I completely agree. If you define racist as hate every black person, racism. That is not who they are. But if you redefine it as a sort of a common sense racism, as a tendency to see themselves, others, society, and the state in terms of a racial narrative of hardworking, decent whites and threatening minorities, yeah, they subscribe to that sort of common sense racism. And so one last comment. What's the matter with white voters? A play on what's the matter with Kansas, right? This book is in part in conversation with Thomas Frank. Frank is completely right when he says Republicans are using culture war politics to convince people to vote against their economic interests. He's completely wrong when he dismisses race. Frank, in both that book and in Pity the Billionaires, says Americans don't do racism. Yeah, he's right, again, if we mean hate every black person racism. But that's a definition of racism that itself reflects the success of a conservative project to narrow the definition of racism. If instead we understand that there are racisms and that racial stereotypes continue to be very powerful in our society, in our politics, you bet Americans do racism. Look again at the demographics, of the Republican Party.
So when we talk about those who perpetuate dog whistle politics, you have a line in your book that says another defensive move, increasingly typical of conservative race talk, is hiding behind a minority.
Absolutely.
And so I think of Clarence Thomas, Condoleezza Rice, Marco Rubio.
Absolutely.
So what exactly are they doing, really?
Or Herman Cain.
Herman Cain.
So if you think that dog whistle politics is about bigotry, you can't make sense of this, right? And so a lot of Tea Partiers, a lot of Republicans say to themselves, how could I possibly be racist? I supported Herman Cain, or I idolized Clarence Thomas. We nominated Michael Steele to be Republican National Committee Chair. How could we possibly be racist? And again, that's not what we mean. This isn't about hate every black person bigotry. This is about a willingness to use race in a way that maintains plausible deniability. And what better way to deny that you're engaging in race baiting than to put minorities to the fore? And so you see Herman Cain, who was egregious, because not only was he espousing all the dog whistle themes of irresponsible minority sucking the teat of government, but he himself was enacting a form of minstrelsy. Right? Oh, shucky ducky. Right? He was acting the buffoon. And yet garnering a lot of support. Partly because the people who were supporting him felt reassured, felt that there was a level of racial expiation, felt like, how could I possibly be racist? Yes, I believe minorities are a threat. Yes, I think welfare is rampant. I'm entertained by this minstrelsy, but I support a black man. Right? This is exactly sort of one of the newest sort of fronts in dog whistle politics. Let me give you another one. Not simply to put minority spokespersons forward, but to claim that conservative policies are actually intended to help minorities, and in particular, minority school children. So public education has been a constant theme in dog whistle politics, and you can understand it if you back out and think about it from the sort of anti-New Deal perspective. Public education is expensive. Public education provides a source of revenue that could be transferred to the private market. Public education involves unionized teachers who overwhelmingly are liberal. Right? So you can understand the attraction of public education as a target. You can also see its attraction as a rhetoric. One of the strongest rhetorics of dog whistle politics starts with states' rights, which is a way to say the right of southern states to resist school integration. Another one used by Richard Nixon is forced busing. And of course, he didn't mean the harm of putting children on buses. He meant the harm of the integration that busing was supposed to achieve. Today, public education, because of the segregation that has occurred, is now often understood as education or as a public service by minorities. But another example of how liberal government is failing minorities in these warehouse institutions with unruly children who are inherently ineducable. Right? That's the image of public education. But now you have conservative politicians like Eric Cantor saying, what we really need, what's really going to help minority school children is charter schools. And I'm here to plug charter schools for the inner city father in Washington, D.C. And he actually said this, inner city father in Washington, D.C. Well, inner city father in Washington, D.C., that clearly codes as black. He's saying, I'm here to help black children. But behind that facade, we see an effort to defund public education, an effort to transfer the money from public education into private hands, and an effort to demonize public education as yet another example of the way in which government fails all Americans. Don't trust government, trust the marketplace. This is the sort of conservative assault on New Deal liberalism with a racialized cast, though now it's been gussied up as somehow as helping minorities, right? I expect that we'll see this sort of dog whistle politics continuing. I want to just make one more comment about this. I want to bring in the Willie Horton ad. So I think a lot of you are familiar with Willie Horton. Willie Horton was a 1988 campaign in which George H.W. Bush used the photo of a convict who escaped from a furlough program, who kidnapped a white couple, who raped a white woman. He used this in a way that dramatically shifted the 1988 election. Today, to say Willie Horton is to invoke a shorthand for egregious racial demagoguery. And what I want to point out was that it took 3 years before the mainstream media and the mass public came to understand the Willie Horton ads as racial demagoguery. When Jesse Jackson mentioned this in the midst of the Willie Horton campaign, he was roundly rebuked for race baiting, for playing the race card. Right? It took 3 years. And this is the truth about dog whistle politics. What works as a dog whistle goad constantly evolves. It must, because you have to have the sense of plausible deniability and yet strong racial agitation. So it's always the case that people are looking for and inventing new ways to exploit racial fears, but that also allows plausible deniability. And unfortunately, it's often the case that we don't recognize the power race is playing in politics until the damage has already been done.
So there are at least three questions, and I'm going to try to combine them into one. Looking forward to 2016, both parties will likely field white candidates. How do you see dog whistle politics playing out? In addition, on an individual level, how do we combat dog whistle politics? How do we counter the messaging?
I think dog whistle... So let me answer very quickly about 2016 and both candidates. I think politicians are quite clear-eyed about the power of race in American politics. Now, they are also clear-eyed about the rhetoric around race, which means that both Republicans and Democrats feel that they must deny that race is powerful in American politics, but I think they're quite clear-eyed. And so, for example, in 2008, running against Obama, Hillary Clinton was forthright in saying Obama's going to have trouble getting the vote of white working class members. This is one of the strongest arguments in favor of my nomination. I think politicians are quite clear-eyed about this. I think we can expect dog whistle politics to continue. How might we change the trajectory? I think that we need to do two things, and I think we need to do them simultaneously. On the one hand, I think we need to reclaim liberalism. This is fundamentally about what is happening to the middle class. Or to put this more starkly, we now have a political system in which the rules of government and the rules of the marketplace are rigged for the very rich. And nothing's going to get better for anybody until that changes. And that changes when we reclaim liberalism. The moment we reclaim liberalism, we will be met with racial challenges. And so simultaneously, we also need to start to name and denounce dog whistle politics. We cannot hide our heads in the sand anymore. We need to say, this is a country that is fundamentally liberal, that understood from the 30s through the 60s the importance of all being in this together, of progressive taxation, of investment infrastructure, of the creation of a social safety net. That's who we are as a country. We need to reclaim that identity and say to conservatives and to Democrats, we refuse to be divided by a racial politics that presents government as simply by and for minorities. Good government is by and for all of us. Right? And I really think, I don't expect the Democrats to do this. I think that this is going to have to happen with pressure outside of the Democratic Party. I think this is going to reflect a certain level of consciousness raising and organizing on the left of the Democratic Party. At the same time, I don't think we should make the mistake of thinking that we can do this wholly outside of the Democratic Party. There needs to be an effort to push the Democratic Party to support candidates within the party who are more responsive to both a sort of a liberalism and an anti-racism, a politics of liberalism and of anti-racism. I do believe this is a medium-term project. I can't see this happening by 2016, but I also firmly believe we need to start. We need to start. We can't continually say to ourselves, all of this is going to take care of itself. We can just wait. We need to start. And I think we can start in 2014. We can start in 2016, maybe 2020. We can really push this message.
When in your book, you mentioned that dog whistle politics, the success of it depends upon never mentioning race, not calling it for what it is. Will you talk a bit about that?
I do believe that most people who respond positively to dog whistle politics are firmly convinced they are not racist. No, let me say that more positively. Are firmly committed to a politics of racial, are firmly committed to a morality of racial egalitarianism. I really believe in the fundamental decency of the American people, even as I believe that racial stereotypes are potent and distort our politics. I believe in the fundamental decency of the American people. Yes, some voters would respond to challenges to dog whistle politics by saying, you know, if this person's appealing for racial solidarity, I'm with them. But I think most voters would be given pause. I think there's actually some good social scientific evidence of this. If you name it, yes, the politics around race blows up. It becomes contentious. You're accused of being a racist for calling out dog whistle racism. You're accused of playing the race card. But there's some good social science, and I think also this sort of sense of who people are and what the ethos in this country is. it gives people pause. They slow down. They think about whether it's work, whether they're being bamboozled by race or not. And that creates an openness to a new narrative. And there is a powerful new narrative. Well, it's not so new. There's a powerful narrative that goes back to Teddy Roosevelt and the Progressive Era, that goes back to FDR and the New Deal. And the narrative is, we need to be worried about the power of concentrated wealth. We need to be worried about efforts by the very rich to hijack government and hijack the marketplace in a way that serves only them. That narrative is out there. We need to resurrect that narrative. People can hear, can embrace that narrative again if we disrupt the racial narrative. And so I think that it's just incredibly important for as many different people, different actors, different institutions, different domains to contest the continuing prevalence of racial appeals in our politics.
You know, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for one last question, and I'd like to not ask you a last question. Instead, I'd like to have a different request. I ask that you close by reading a passage from your book, and in particular, I believe there's a few sentences in your introduction that I think would be a good way to bring a close to this conversation.
First, I want to say thank you, Judge. This has been terrific, and to thank all of you. So let me close with this. Dog Whistle Politics aims to lay bare how race has become, and at least in the medium term will remain, central to American electoral politics and the fate of the middle class. Even when willing to concede that race matters when talking about the lives of poor minorities, members of the middle class nevertheless typically harbor an unfounded certainty that race holds little relevance to them or their future. They could not be more wrong. For race constitutes the dark magic by which middle-class voters have been convinced to turn government over to the wildly affluent, notwithstanding the harm this does to themselves. This book's primary goal is to grab the attention of middle-class readers, white and non-white alike, to awaken them to the importance of race to their fate. We will not pull government back to the side of the broad middle until we confront the power of racial politics.
Thank you. Our thanks to Professor Ian Haney Lopez, University of California, Berkeley Law Professor, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. I believe this book is a must read. And I believe, as people who care about this country, we need to get the word out about this book. It should be read. We also want to thank our audiences here on radio, television, and on the Internet. I am Ladaris Hazard Cordell, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.
Thanks, Judge. I appreciate it. That was good.